The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Maybe I should begin by saying I'm the early one. I'm Fisher. And I would like to begin with an introduction of my own. You'll hear the word we deployed here this evening. And we refers to Judy and me. Judy is sitting in the front row in the blue jacket. She is a botanist and a biologist, and I am a historian, and we have been botanizing and historicizing together since 1958 when we met at Johns Hopkins, and something else happened in 1958. We also met Jim McPherson at Johns Hopkins. Judy's courtship consisted in part of forced marches to Civil War battlefields led by Jim McPherson and Pat McPherson. And there were many other adventures along the way. Let me just speak very informally about what I've been doing. First, to say a few words about the other books that Ellis mentioned. Most of what I've been doing in my recent books is a study of origins. And in particular, I've been interested in the way that small beginnings can make a large difference in the history of great nations. And I started doing that in a book called Albion's Seed in 1989, which was about regional origins. It was about four folk cultures from different parts of Britain to different parts of the U.S. One of them went from the North Midlands to this part of the U.S., to the Delaware Valley. And I think that these four cultures shaped, in many ways, the regional folkways of this great republic. Then there were three other books that looked at national origins, and that was Paul Revere's Ride, Washington's Crossing, and a book called Liberty and Freedom, which was the last to appear. There I was also interested in the difference that leaders made, not only people of high standing, but others very broadly distributed through those societies. And leadership became another theme along with origins. And then more recently, historians everywhere have been thinking globally. We've been looking for our origins in ways that are not limited by our national boundaries. And Samuel Champlain was a figure who moved in that larger sphere, as well as in more local ways. And I got into it that way. It started in a very local way. Judy and I divide our time between the Boston area and Mount Desert Island off the coast of Maine. And absolutely everybody on Mount Desert Island knows Samuel Champlain. He named the place. He gave it its identity. And it was from that beginning that a series of inquiries followed. We knew Champlain, first of all, as an explorer, as a seaman. It was a brilliant seaman. As a map maker, very busy in all of those careers. And the more we got into it, the more we discovered he was a seaman who made 27 Atlantic crossings in the years from 1603 to 1635. He never lost his ship, and as near as I can tell, lost only one man in that time. The most extraordinary testament to his seamanship was what happened on a day when things went wrong in coastal waters in the Gulf of Maine. He was sailing as a passenger in a small bark, and they were caught in a gale of the sort that often arises in those waters, and they were on a lee shore. The captain of the bark suffered a heart attack, and Champlain instantly took command. He set all the sails, and they were lug sails, very difficult to manage, and he drove that bark headlong on the rocks along the coast and smashed it to kindling wood. but he saved the life of every man aboard. And I think that sort of skill in seamanship in the disaster that he faced was in some ways more striking to me than his many successes. He made maps of remarkable accuracy. Cartographers have been fascinated and puzzled by them. His maps are in some ways more accurate than his instruments. And the question is, how could he have done that? And it appears that he did it by also inventing a new way of exploring, which he, in his own language, called ferreting. He went very close to those dangerous coasts and was able to check his bearings using a tiny little astrolabe, compasses, and not much more, a lead line. And he worked out maps that had a refinement and accuracy of detail that I think nobody else could match in that period. And so we began to look into this man a little further, and as we dug, more and more layers began to appear. The first that we got into was his relations with the Indians. He got on with the Indians in a most remarkable way. It was a story that began, he planned for this very carefully, in 1603, when he first ventured into the St. Lawrence River, sailing up this gigantic estuary. The mouth of the St. Lawrence River is about 100 miles wide. And there's a river that flows in from the north. It's called the Saguenay River, which is the most beautiful river I have ever seen in North America. It's almost like a fjord, more like that than other rivers. And it's bigger than any of the rivers in France, though only a small tributary of the St. Lawrence. And he landed on one side of that river and looked across and saw a gathering of three groups of Indian nations. More than 1,000 Indians were there. They were the people that he called Montagnais from downstream of St. Lawrence. They were the Algonquian-speaking people further up the river. They were the people of the northern coast of what is now New England. And Champlain, they were having a great ceremony, a festival, a celebration, victory. They had just won a battle over their hereditary enemies, the Iroquois. Champlain, with one Frenchman and two young Indians whom they had brought to France to learn French so they could serve as interpreters. And these four people, two young Indian princes, as Champlain called them, and two Frenchmen, walked unarmed into the middle of that gathering, and they had a party that Champlain called a tabagie, a tobacco feast, and it went on all night. He could communicate with the Indians, and they listened to each other. And when morning came, they adjourned the party across the river to the other shore, and they partied for another day and night. And at the end of it, they made a kind of informal alliance. And the alliance persisted between the people of France and the people of those three groups of Indian nations for about eight generations. And he did that up and down the coast and well into the interior, he himself getting as far west as two of the Great Lakes, north along the Ottawa River, and he made agreements like that with something like 50 Indian nations, with all the Indian nations he met except the Iroquois, who eluded him. And then he sent other people out further to the west, whom he called his truchement. It's an unusual word. It's an exotic word in French. It comes from Arabic. And it was a word that the French added to their language during the Crusades to describe people who mediated between the Islamic people of the Middle East and the Europeans in that earlier era. And the truchement got as far south as Philadelphia. They got even to the Chesapeake Bay, and they went west into the Mississippi Valley, north to to Hudson's Bay, and where they went on Champlain's instructions to meet the Indians, to learn their languages, to understand their customs, to make alliances, he established a kind of reach over a very large part of North America. The amazing thing to me is that he not only did those things, but he also founded colonies. He founded the first permanent French colony in North America, which was Quebec in 1608, now having its 400th anniversary. And it was the first settlement that actually survived in New France. There had been many, many earlier ones that had failed. He got that one going. It was a very desperate venture, often collapsed, was conquered by the English midway through Champlain's career, and then recovered by Champlain. He made a go of it. But the more important thing he did was to get started three groups of people, French-speaking all, who began to increase and multiply in North America. One of them were the Quebecois, the people of the St. Lawrence Valley. They came from a special part of France, the area around Normandy. Another were the people of Acadia, who came more from the south-central part of France, where Champlain began. And then there was a third group that was most interesting to me. It was the people who were called Métis. They called themselves Métis, Métis in metropolitan French today, the mixed ones. And they began to grow from those contacts that these Truchements made, often taking Indian wives, and the numbers increased and multiplied continuously through the next four centuries, so that in the last census in Canada, nearly a million people, when asked to identify their ethnicity, call themselves Métis, the product of this process called Métissage. And these three groups, which today count their descendants in many millions, not only in Canada, but also in the United States and around the world with the great diaspora of the Acadians, these people are, I think, Champlain's most extraordinary, most durable legacy. The other thing Champlain did, which may be of some relevance to the second half of this program, is that he was a gifted leader. And he worked with an idea of humanity, which I think was really driving him. It came from the experience of growing up in a very difficult period of French history. He was born in 1570 or thereabouts, we're not sure exactly. And he lived through a period of civil wars that went on for nearly 40 years. The French experienced nine civil wars from 1562 until 1598. And these were civil wars of religion. They were incredibly violent, and they were marked by atrocities beyond imagining. And they not only was it all of that, but they took a terrific toll in that there was very little in the way of distinctions between soldiers and civilians, and entire towns and cities were put to the sack and to the sword. And it's been estimated by the most recent and careful student of the casualties that something like 2 million people died in these nine civil wars that Champlain, most of them Champlain lived through. We had one civil war, 4 years, 600,000 combatant deaths, and it's still one of the dominant facts in our history. It's difficult even to imagine what Champlain went through in this other horrific period. And there was one man in France who became very important to Champlain. It was Henry IV, the first Bourbon king of France, who undertook to end these civil wars and to impose a policy of toleration. And with a great effort, he succeeded in doing that. Champlain was one of millions of Frenchmen who joined the armies of Henry IV and soldiered for him, Champlain mainly in the last of these religious wars. And in the end came in 1598, finally Henry IV, with Champlain soldiering beside him, put an end to the violence, drove out the foreign armies who were in there from Spain and Italy, and then in the same year issued his Edict of Toleration, the Edict of Nantes, which guaranteed the rights of worship for both Protestants and Catholics. And then these remarkable men looked abroad. They looked beyond France, looked to the New World. And Champlain, who was not only a soldier but also a secret agent for the king, was given a mission of espionage. He was told to visit Spanish dominions and to look at what he saw there. And he made a report for one man, for Henry IV, illustrated it. He was a very good artist, and he produced watercolors. And quite a number of those watercolors are scenes of the exploitation of American Indians and of the cruelties that were visited upon them. One shows the Indians of Mexico being burnt alive for heresy. Another shows Indians in Mexico being cudgeled by the orders of Spanish priests who were standing looking on for not attending Mass. Others show the horror of the pearl fisheries in the Spanish Empire, one of the cruelest of all these exploitations, in which first Indians and then African slaves were forced to dive to lethal depths in search of pearls, and very few of them survived that labor. Champlain drew an image of that scene, which he witnessed with his own eyes, brought it back to Henry IV, was given a pension and a job in the basement of the Louvre, which was the great palace at that time of the king in Paris. And his job was to plan another sort of empire in North America. And these men were driven by a vision of toleration and humanity in a world of cruelty and inhumanity that they had lived through. And they tried to establish an empire that was based on that idea. It was a set of many circles of humanists around Henry IV. The one we would know best was Montaigne. And there were many others of that sort. And Champlain was spinning in those circles. And what he did was then to set all of that in motion. And that was what lay behind that tabagie at Sadoujac, at Saguenay. And it was what set that entire process in motion, which brought with it the idea of cohabitation between the French and the Indians. And then one last thing, and then I'll stop, was that Champlain, even as he did all these things, wrote a book about how it was done. It was a treatise on leadership. And it centered on one French word that has no English equivalent. The word was prévoyance, which is often translated foresight. But in some way, its meaning was the opposite of foresight. What it referred to was the problem of leading when the future is unknown to us, when the outcome of many things in our world is very much in doubt, where one is engaged in projects of great difficulty and danger. And his treatise was a manual on how to deal with that. It was on how to combine boldness with prudence, on how to lead in a reflective way, avoiding the sort of impulse that others might have done. It was how to prepare for the worst case, even as one aimed for the best. It was about staying alert in the time of maximum danger. It was about a seaman's weather eye in small ways and large. It was for him, one of his rules was always to sleep in the daytime and stay awake at night, which was the dangerous time when others were less alert. And there were many other rules of that sort. And I think this is the only book I've ever read on leadership that centers on this idea of prévoyance. I'm going to anglicize the word because I think we could use some prévoyance just now in our time. And in that way, perhaps we have, in a distant manner, an analog to Abraham Lincoln.
Well, thanks, David, for that great segue. As David said, we've known each other for half a century now and have been interacting as historians in many different ways. I think I learned as much from David as a graduate student as I did from many of my professors at Johns Hopkins. He was certainly a leader in all respects in what I still look back on as one of the best times of my life. When President Abraham Lincoln called state militia into federal service on April 15, 1861, to put down what he called combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings, The new president faced a steep learning curve as commander-in-chief. Lincoln had no previous military experience except a short stint as a militia captain in the Black Hawk War back in 1832, in which he saw no action except, as he wryly put it, charges upon the wild onions and a good many bloody struggles with the mosquitoes. As commander-in-chief in time of war, a president performs or oversees three principal functions. First, policy. Second, national strategy. And finally, military strategy. Policy refers to war aims, the political goals of the nation in time of war. National strategy refers to mobilization of the political, economic, diplomatic, and psychological, as well as military resources of the nation to achieve those war aims. Military strategy, probably pretty obvious, refers to plans for the employment of armed forces to win victories that will further the political goals. And what I want to do this evening is to focus briefly on each of these three functions as Lincoln conceived of them, learned them, carried them out. From first to last, Lincoln's policy, the war aims, was preservation of the United States as one nation, indivisible, and as a republic based on majority rule. In May 1861, he explained that the central idea pervading this struggle is the necessity of proving that popular government is not an absurdity. We must settle this question now, whether in a free government the minority have the right to break up the government whenever they choose. On another occasion, Lincoln described secession as the essence of anarchy, because if one state may secede, so may any and all others until there is no government and no nation. And for Lincoln, this issue of national sovereignty over a union of all the states was non-negotiable. No compromise between a sovereign United States and a separately sovereign Confederate States was possible. This question, Lincoln said in 1864, is distinct, simple, and inflexible. It is an issue which can only be tried by war. That's, of course, where I got my title. And decided by victory. The next level of presidential duty as commander-in-chief was to mobilize the means to achieve that policy by winning the war. The president, of course, shares with Congress and key cabinet members the tasks of raising, organizing, and sustaining an army and navy, preventing foreign intervention in the conflict, and maintaining public support for the war. But as a later president said, Harry Truman, the buck stops on the president's desk. And this responsibility was as much a political as a military one, especially in a civil war whose origins lay in an internal political conflict and that had been precipitated by political decisions. Although Lincoln never read the famous Prussian military theorist Karl von Clausewitz's treatise Vom Kriege, on war, his actions were a consummate expression of Clausewitz's central argument. The political objective is the goal, war is the means of reaching it, and means can never be considered in isolation from their purpose. Therefore, it is clear that war should never be thought of as something autonomous, but always as an instrument of policy. Or as the French Prime Minister Georges Clemenceau put it a half a century later, war is too important to be left to the generals. Some professional military men, though, tended to think of war as something autonomous and deplored the intrusion of political considerations into the military sphere. Take the notable, some might say notorious, example of what were called at the time political generals. Lincoln appointed a number of prominent politicians of both parties with little or no military training or experience to the rank of brigadier or major general. Some of them received these appointments so early in the war that they subsequently outranked professional West Point-educated officers. Lincoln also commissioned important ethnic leaders as generals with only marginal consideration of their military merits. Some of those political and ethnic generals proved to be incompetent on the battlefield. As one of the most consummate professionals, Henry W. Halleck, who for part of the war was general-in-chief, as Halleck put it, sighing with frustration in 1864, "It seems but little better than murder to give important commands to such men as Nathaniel Banks, Benjamin Butler, John McClernand, and Lew Wallace, but it seems impossible to prevent it." Well, these whom Halleck mentioned and others certainly did not leave a sterling military record, but often overlooked are the excellent records of some other political generals who turned out to have a natural aptitude for command and made important contributions to military success. John A. Logan of Illinois and Francis P. Blair of Missouri, among others, both of whom became corps commanders under General William T. Sherman. Logan and Blair, among others, come to mind. And some West Pointers, notably Ulysses S. Grant and William T. Sherman, might have languished in obscurity if it had not been for the initial sponsorship of Grant by Congressman Elihu B. Washburn of Illinois and of Sherman by his brother John, a senator from Ohio. But even if all political generals or generals in whose appointments politics had played a part had turned out to have had mediocre military records, that process would still have had a positive impact on national strategy. The main purpose of commissioning prominent political and ethnic leaders was to mobilize their constituencies for the war effort. The United States Army on the eve of the war consisted of about 16,000 men, tiny regular army in a nation of 32 million people, and most of those were scattered across the frontier in small units. By April 1862, when the war was only a year old, the all-volunteer Union Army consisted of 637,000 men in 1 year, going from 16,000 to 637,000. That mass mobilization could not have taken place without an enormous effort by local and state politicians as well as by prominent ethnic leaders. In New York City, for example, the Tammany Hall Democrat, Daniel Sickles, raised a brigade and earned a commission as Brigadier General. The Irish-born Thomas Maher helped raise the famous Irish Brigade. And the German-American leader Carl Schurz helped raise several German regiments and eventually became a Major General. And so it went across the North. By 1862, the need for politically motivated commissions to cement allegiances, mobilize support, and reward support declined. Performance in action became the principal determinant for promotion to higher rank in the officer corps, though, of course, politics, as you might well imagine, could never be completely absent from that process in a highly politicized and democratic society. But the national strategy of mobilizing political support for the war effort through military patronage had largely served its purpose, as the latest student of this subject has stated, the purpose of convincing the people to join the mass citizen army as volunteers. The infusion of politics into military appointments would have some impact on military strategy, and I'll get to that third function of Lincoln as commander-in-chief in a few moments. But first, another important matter that began as a question of national strategy eventually crossed the line in the other direction to become policy, and that was the question of slavery and emancipation. In the first year of the war, a primary goal of Lincoln's national strategy was to mobilize maximum support from Northern Democrats and border slave state unionists for the war effort. The policy of restoring the Union, united these groups with the Northerners of Lincoln's own Republican Party. But the issue of slavery, and especially of emancipation, badly divided them. So to keep his war coalition together, to keep it from falling apart, Lincoln had to suppress any sign of making this war for the Union into a war against slavery. In August 1861 and again in May 1862, he rescinded military orders by Union generals in Missouri and in the occupied areas of the South Atlantic coast, emancipating slaves in those districts. to one Republican who protested against Lincoln's revocation of General John C. Fremont's Emancipation Edict in Missouri. Lincoln wrote that this edict, if sustained, would alarm our Southern Union friends and turn them against us, perhaps ruin our rather fair prospect for Kentucky. I think that to lose Kentucky is nearly the same as to lose the whole game. Kentucky gone, we cannot hold Missouri, nor, as I think, Maryland. Those all against us, and the job in our hands is too large for us. We would as well consent to separation at once, including the surrender of this capital. That was in September 1861. But during the next 9 months or so, the thrust of national strategy on this question shifted away step by step, fitfully, with a lot of backing and filling, shifted away from conciliating the border slave states and anti-emancipation Democrats. The anti-slavery Republican constituency grew louder and more demanding. The argument that what was called in those days the slave power had brought on the war, and that reunion with slavery would only sow the seeds of another war, became more insistent. The evidence that slave labor sustained the Confederate economy and the logistics of Confederate armies grew stronger. Counteroffensive by Southern armies in the summer of 1862 wiped out many of the Union gains of the previous winter and spring. So many Northerners, including Lincoln, became convinced that bolder steps were necessary. To win the war over an enemy fighting for and sustained by slavery, the North must strike against slavery. So in July 1862, Lincoln decided on a major change in national strategy. Instead of deferring to the border states and Northern Democrats, he would activate the dynamism of the Northern anti-slavery majority that had elected him and mobilize the potential of black manpower for the North by issuing a proclamation of freedom for slaves in rebellious states. Lincoln seized upon the limited Union victory in the Battle of Antietam as the occasion to issue a preliminary proclamation warning the rebellious states that on January 1, 1863, he would invoke his war powers, and it was Lincoln who invented both the phraseology and the concept of war powers, his war powers as commander-in-chief to seize enemy property, in this case slaves, by proclaiming emancipation in all states or parts of states then still in rebellion. January 1 came, the rebellion still raged, and Lincoln issued his historic proclamation. A national strategy of confiscating enemy slave property, which is what the Emancipation Proclamation was, in order to weaken that enemy, was obviously inconsistent with a policy of restoring the Union of 1861, because that was a union in which nearly half of the states were slave states. This inconsistency was resolved over the last 2 years of the war, during which emancipation evolved from a means of winning the war to a war aim, that is, from national strategy to national policy. Lincoln was reelected in 1864 on a platform calling not only for unconditional surrender of the Confederacy, but also a 13th Amendment to the Constitution to abolish slavery everywhere and forever. Lincoln's dominant role in determining policy and national strategy, the two topics I've been looking at so far, is scarcely surprising. But he also took a more active, hands-on part in shaping military strategy than presidents have done in most other wars. That was not necessarily by choice. Lincoln's lack of military training inclined him at first to defer to General-in-Chief Winfield Scott, America's most celebrated soldier since George Washington. But Scott's age, his poor health, his lack of energy, his desire to retire, place a greater burden than Lincoln had anticipated on him. Scott's successors as generals-in-chief, General George B. McClellan and then Henry W. Halleck, proved to be even greater disappointments to Lincoln. Nor did field commanders Don Carlos Buell, John Pope, Ambrose Burnside, Joseph Hooker, George Gordon Meade, William S. Rosecrans, or preeminently as commander of the Army of the Potomac, George B. McClellan, live up to initial expectations. When Ulysses S. Grant became General-in-Chief in March 1864, Lincoln told him, according to Grant's memoirs, that, in Grant's paraphrase of Lincoln's remark, he had never professed to be a military man or to know how campaigns should be conducted, and never wanted to interfere in them, but that procrastination on the part of commanders had compelled him to take a more active part. Grant's account doesn't ring entirely true. Lincoln, by then, had already gained a lot of experience and confidence that he did know how campaigns should be conducted. But it is quite true that, as Grant quoted Lincoln, procrastination, especially by McClellan and Buell, had caused Lincoln to become, in effect, his own general-in-chief as well as commander-in-chief during key campaigns. We don't have time for a discussion of all these campaigns. Instead, what I would like to do is to focus on a few key facets of Lincoln's military strategy. And the first was Lincoln's emphasis, which developed through experience, on what military analysts call concentration in time to counteract the Confederacy's ability to use interior lines to concentrate in space. Well, what does that mean? Just visualize the geography of the United States and the Confederate States in 1861. The Confederacy was surrounded on the north and west by the United States and on the south by the Gulf of Mexico and the east by the Atlantic Ocean. To invade and conquer the Confederacy, Union forces were compelled by these geographical circumstances to operate mainly on exterior lines, that is, to move from outside the perimeter of the Confederate States towards some interior point. The Confederacy, defending that territory, could use interior lines to shift forces from one or more less threatened points to the most threatened one. To illustrate, in January 1862, Generals Henry W. Halleck and Don Carlos Buell commanded two Union armies in Missouri and Kentucky that Lincoln wanted to cooperate in a joint campaign against Confederate defenses in Kentucky and Tennessee. Both generals stalled and made excuses for their inability to cooperate, and Halleck lectured Lincoln by letter. To operate on exterior lines against an enemy occupying a central position will fail, he wrote to Lincoln. It is condemned by every military authority I have ever read. But Lincoln had been reading some of his own military authorities in a kind of cram course to learn more about military strategy and history. And his response to Halleck showed how well he had learned a key lesson. I state my general idea of this war, Lincoln wrote, that we have the greater numbers and the enemy has the greater facility of concentrating forces upon points of collision, that we must fail unless we can find some way of making our advantage an overmatch for his, and that this can only be done by menacing him with superior forces at different points at the same time, so that we can safely attack one or both if he makes no change, and if he weakens one to strengthen the other, forbear to attack the strengthened one, and seize and hold the weakened one, gaining so much. This is one of the clearest expressions of the strategy of concentration in time that I've read. By advancing on two or more fronts simultaneously, Union forces could neutralize the Confederacy's use of interior lines to shift troops to the most endangered front, because they'd all be endangered. The proof of Lincoln's point came when, after Grant captured Forts Henry and Donelson in February 1862, Halleck's and Buell's armies then advanced more or less simultaneously and forced the enemy out of Kentucky and out of most of Tennessee. 2 years later, when Grant became General-in-Chief, he put Lincoln's strategy of simultaneous advances against several enemy points into effect on the major fronts of the war by coordinating or trying to coordinate the invasions of key parts of Confederate territory by several armies simultaneously. Lincoln told his private secretary, John Hay, in April 1864, that Grant's plans reminded him of his own, this is Hay now quoting Lincoln, his own suggestion so constantly made and is constantly neglected to Buell and Halleck et al. To move at once upon the enemy's whole line so as to bring into action to our advantage our great superiority in numbers. A second key aspect of Lincoln's strategy, and military strategy, and Grant's for that matter, was to go after enemy armies and attack them where they were, rather than to maneuver to try to capture places, territory, even such important places as Richmond. That was one reason the Confederacy was only going to be subdued when its armies were subdued. Occupying territory wasn't going to do it as long as those armies still remained viable and capable of reconquering it. This was one reason why Lincoln opposed McClellan's strategy to take the Army of the Potomac all the way down the Chesapeake Bay to the Virginia Peninsula in 1862, 120 miles from Washington, to begin a campaign against Richmond from there instead of attacking the enemy army where it was, only 25 miles from Washington, in northern Virginia along the Manassas-Centerville line. When Lincoln nevertheless reluctantly approved McClellan's plan, despite his continuing skepticism about it, and when McClellan then hesitated to attack a small Confederate blocking force at Yorktown despite overwhelming numerical superiority, Lincoln told him, "It is indispensable to you that you strike a blow. You will do me the justice to remember I always insisted that going down the bay in search of a field, instead of fighting at or near Manassas, was only shifting and not surmounting a difficulty, that we would find the same or equal entrenchments at either place. The country will not fail to note, is now noting, that the present hesitation to move upon an entrenched enemy is but the story of Manassas repeated." And then Lincoln concluded, "You must act," and he underlined these words. But the general who acquired the nickname of Tardy George never learned that lesson. Lincoln finally gave up, using a metaphor to describe McClellan, as he so often liked to use metaphors, finally gave up trying to bore with an auger too dull to take hold, and removed McClellan from command. But Lincoln had similar problems with some of McClellan's successors. When the Army of Northern Virginia began to move north in the campaign that led to Gettysburg, Union General Joseph Hooker proposed to cut in behind them and attack Richmond. Lincoln rejected that idea. "Lee's army, and not Richmond, is your true objective point," he wrote to Hooker, he wired him, on June 10, 1863. "If he comes toward the upper Potomac, follow on his flank and on the inside track, shortening your supply lines whilst he lengthens his. Fight him when opportunity offers." A week later, as the enemy was entering Pennsylvania, Lincoln told Hooker that "this invasion gives you back the chance that I thought McClellan lost last fall, to cripple Lee's army far from its base." Hooker's complaints and bickering with General-in-Chief Halleck finally caused Lincoln to replace Hooker on June 28th with George Gordon Meade, who punished but did not destroy Lee at Gettysburg. When the rising Potomac trapped Lee in Maryland for 10 days, Lincoln urged Meade to close in for the kill. "If Meade," he telegraphed him, "could complete his work so gloriously prosecuted thus far by the literal or substantial destruction of Lee's army, the rebellion will be over." Lincoln was distressed by Meade's congratulatory order to his army on July 7th, just 4 days after the end of Gettysburg, which closed with the words that "the country now looks for the army for greater efforts to drive from our soil every vestige of the presence of the invader." When Lincoln read these words, he threw up his hands and said, "Great God, will our generals never get that idea out of their heads? The whole country is our soil. That, after all, was the point of the war. The war could never be won merely by driving the enemy back to Virginia, but only, as Lincoln put it, by the literal or substantial destruction of enemy armies." A third and related hallmark of Lincoln's strategic thinking was that Confederate offensives constituted more of an opportunity than a threat to the Union cause, an opportunity to trap enemy armies that were raiding or invading northward by cutting into the south of them, forcing them to fight their way back, blocking their routes of retreat. 5 times during the war, Lincoln tried to get his field commanders to do this. During Stonewall Jackson's drive north through the Shenandoah Valley in May 1862, Lee's invasion of Maryland in September 1862, Braxton Bragg's simultaneous invasion of Kentucky, Lee's invasion of Pennsylvania that led to Gettysburg, and finally Jubal Early's raid to the very outskirts of Washington in 1864. Each time, Lincoln saw this as an opportunity to trap and, if possible, destroy these armies, as he had hoped Meade would do after Gettysburg. But each time his generals failed him, and in each case except Meade after Gettysburg, these generals soon found themselves relieved of command. Meade retained his position, despite Lincoln's grave disappointment, but played second fiddle to Grant in the last year of the war. In the end, Lincoln put together the three principal functions of commander-in-chief in such a way as to win the war and give the nation that new birth of freedom he mentioned at Gettysburg, by refusing to compromise his policy of preserving the United States as one nation, indivisible, and after the Emancipation Proclamation and 13th Amendment, forever free. Second, by a national strategy of mobilizing northern resources, including its political resources, and weakening the enemy by destroying its resources as much as possible, including slavery. And finally, by putting into place a team of military commanders in the final year of the war, most notably Grant, Philip Sheridan, and George Thomas, who actually did destroy enemy armies, and a fourth commander, William T. Sherman, who destroyed enemy resources as well. Whether the war could have been won in any other way with anyone other than Lincoln as commander-in-chief is, of course, unknowable. But, frankly, I doubt it.
Terrific. I didn't know we have these eminent historians, and when I invited them, I thought, how are we going to get from Champlain to Lincoln? And David provided that beautiful French segue. Folks, if you have a question, please raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you, and please wait for the mic. Who would like to start us off? Gentleman in the blue in the middle there. Sir, keep your hand up, please.
First, thank you both for coming and speaking. It's a great pleasure to listen to you. Professor McPherson, my question is for you, and it has to do with slavery. It's a political question. So if the South had not seceded, how do you think slavery would have been resolved, and over what time frame would it have been resolved?
Well, of course, that's the kind of historians, the kind of question that historians blanch at when they're asked because we don't know. Nevertheless, I've been asked it many times, each time I confess that, of course, I don't know. But I can say a few things, one of which was that slavery was probably more viable, more profitable, more dynamic, and the Southern planter class more confident that they had the right kind of labor system in the late 1850s than it had ever been. American cotton exports dominated world trade. Three-quarters of the world's cotton was produced in the American South. It had a greater monopoly on one of the leading commodities in international trade than OPEC does on oil in our time. So there was clearly no economic end of slavery to be foreseen during that time. What the South was afraid of was political domination by the anti-slavery Republican Party, which won votes only in the North, and that's the reason that they seceded. If they had not seceded, I think that slavery would have continued to be viable for at least another generation. maybe even longer than that. Slavery did continue to exist in Cuba and in Brazil into the 1880s and in other parts of the world, even much longer than that. So it isn't as if slavery would have suddenly come to an end in what was the largest slaveholding country in the world, the United States. But eventually, I would think that probably a combination of economic modernization and probably some indigenous anti-slavery movements, even within the South, moving from the Upper South, states like Maryland and Delaware, where slavery was already in the process of disappearing, even before 1861, probably would have shrunk the area of slavery, and economic competition to slave products in from other parts of the world probably would have brought about gradual shrinkage of the profitability of slavery, the viability of it. It's a little hard to imagine it persisting very far into the 20th century, but of course we can't know that. But I'm inclined to think that it would have lasted for another 30 or 40 years at any rate.
Another question. Right here in front.
For Dr. Fisher, why did France not, given particularly given their history of civil wars, not use the New World as a place to populate the same way England used it to their great advantage?
Champlain wanted that to happen, as did, I think, Henry IV. And they gave great encouragement to Huguenots as well as to Catholics. They actually brought over to the first colony that failed a little bit later, St. Croix, both Catholic priests and Protestant ministers, one Protestant minister, two Catholic priests. And it was not a success. They fell to arguing and then to fighting. Fists began to fly. And then they both died of scurvy. And Champlain and his fellow colonists decided that they would both be buried in the same grave in the hopes that they could achieve more harmony in the next world than they were able to do in this one. But after that, Champlain lost some measure of control, particularly after Richelieu emerged as the chief minister under Louis XIII. The Richelieu and others around him very much wanted to exclude the heretics from New France. They never fully succeeded, but the policy was the reverse of what was done in England, where I think some English ministers were happy to see, some English monarchs were happy to see Puritan groups on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. And I think it was that decision that really decisively put a stop to the possibility of French dissenters, of whom there were so many, increasing the population of New France.
Over here on my left, gentleman in the white.
Hi, I have two quick ones. First of all, what happened with the Iroquois that eluded Champlain? And I know the famous engraving of him fighting them,
yes.
So something must have gone seriously wrong. And I'm always also curious, whenever McClellan is mentioned today, he's always laughed at and derided. And yet he got so many votes in 1864. He became governor of New Jersey. What did they not know what we know now? Did they not have it?
Well, New Jersey, you know New Jersey. But.
The Iroquois question is more complicated, and but the short of it is that Champlain walked into a condition of hereditary warfare in the St. Lawrence Valley, and it didn't arise from the fur trade, as some people have said, though I think the fur trade greatly stimulated it, and the Iroquois were continuously raiding north into the St. Lawrence. Champlain tried to make peace with them. He would free Iroquois captives from the northern nations and return them, and it didn't work. So what he tried to do was to launch a policy of controlled punitive strikes to raise the cost of of warfare in the valley for the Iroquois. And he did that in 1609. We're about to have yet another quadricentennial of Champlain, which will happen next year on Lake Champlain. It's the 400th anniversary of that battle on the probably at Ticonderoga. Champlain went south with two French soldiers and 60 Indian allies and met about 300 Mohawk on the grounds very near to what is now the fort, Ticonderoga. And there was a battle that was really very interesting in a number of ways. One was that this was the first time the Iroquois had met firearms. And they had engaged in the battle, as had the northern nations, in close order. After they met the arquebus that Champlain was carrying, way of fighting changed, and we went more to the Indians began to adapt that very open way of warfare that we associate with them. It was a revolution in warfare. Champlain succeeded in raising the cost to the Iroquois, in this case particularly to the Mohawk. And there was another battle that followed in what is now the city of Sorel on the south side of the St. Lawrence, which was a complete disaster for the Iroquois. And for 25 years, the Iroquois stopped raiding north. There was a kind of truce that followed. But then after Champlain died, in fact, just with a few incidents before that broke down, Champlain had recommended the continuation of that policy to Richelieu, and he refused to support it. Hostilities began to mount, particularly after 1635, and they would continue to the end of New France.
On McClellan, McClellan is really one of the most complex characters in the war, and I try to get at some of that complexity of his character, his personality, his generalship in the book. He did have the support and love, really, of his soldiers in the Army of the Potomac, and at least in 1861 and 1862. And I think that was partly because he had really created that army. He had trained it. He had instilled it with a kind of pride and esprit. And those soldiers really believed that it was the failure of the government, and especially of the War Department under Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, to support McClellan that explained his failures in the Peninsula Campaign and the Seven Days Battles in the summer of 1862. But it's clear that McClellan had a fatal defect, and that was a lack of what was called in those days of moral courage. That is, the will to act, the will to take the initiative, the will to confront that moment of truth handling a large army. So with the partial exception of Antietam, when he did attack but did not follow through, he was always reacting to the enemy's initiative and always excusing or explaining his inability to take the initiative by claiming that the enemy outnumbered him and by inflating the enemy's strength by a factor of two and sometimes three. Eventually, I think a lot of soldiers became convinced that McClellan was not using them well, especially after Antietam. And while when Lincoln removed him from command, there was a great deal of complaining and muttering and so on among the ranks, and especially among the officer corps, which was also McClellan's creation. As time went on, I think the soldiers became less and less enamored of McClellan. And when he did run for president against Lincoln in 1864, he got a much smaller percentage of the soldier vote than he did of the civilian vote. He got only 22% of the soldier vote. Lincoln carried 78% of the soldier vote in 1864. And New Jersey was, in fact, the only free state that McClellan carried in 1864.
Oh, boy. I see a lot of questions, and we do not have a lot of time. We can do a few more. Gentlemen on the right here.
Uh, This question is for Professor Fisher, and this goes back to Albion Seed, and I just wanted to know if you think that the four folkways that you describe in that book have a relevance still to our political life, particularly I'm thinking of the latest elections, if you could comment on that.
Well, my answer would be unequivocally yes and no. I think that, first of all, these four the four folkways, to summarize in a sentence with three semicolons, were the New England tradition, the Delaware Valley tradition, the Chesapeake tradition, and the backcountry tradition that actually goes from central Pennsylvania south along the spine of the mountains to Georgia. And these cultures did many things differently, lots of ordinary things, but the most enduring importance, I think, was that they had different ideas of liberty, freedom, order, power. And it meant, for one, that they had different, as to liberty, the backcountry settlers took as their symbol the rattlesnake, with that motto that made it very clear, "Don't tread on me," that is, first person singular. A deep antipathy to taxes, for example. The New Englanders had symbols of their towns and the old liberty trees that they invented. And they were happy to support strong local governments as long as they controlled them. The people of the Chesapeake Valley, the Chesapeake region, had an idea of hegemonic liberty. It was an idea of liberty for masters that coexisted very easily with slavery. No contradiction in that idea, because it was built upon an idea of inequality that we don't accept. The culture of this region was built on that Quaker idea of reciprocal liberty, extending to others the liberties that William Penn and the Quakers claimed for themselves. The Liberty Bell made a really good symbol of that, 1750. And then if you look at politics in the 20th century, there are many signs of persistence, even in the midst of change. That is, tax policies and levels of taxation vary by these regions very much. And we can also see different attitudes toward government. The people of the backcountry wanted to be free of government. They had been bullied and tyrannized for 1,000 years by two governments on the borderlands of North Britain. And the people of New England had no fear of government that way, as long as it was their government. And I think we can see this in the voting patterns, even to our own time. And I think one can run that through to, there is a tradition of backcountry presidents. The North Britons have contributed more presidents than any other ethnic group in American history, beginning with Andrew Jackson, who was the first. And I would say that George W. Bush was very much a part of that tradition, even if he was born in New Haven, Connecticut, because he was raised in Midland, Texas. And he was very much a part of that "don't tread on me" culture. But the no part to your answer is that Obama is only the third president who does not come from those four regions. The only others who did not were Martin Van Buren and John Kennedy. And with Obama, things have changed in quite a fundamental way. And now the ethnic map of this country is much more complex, and we have new groups who were, some of them old groups, but now newly engaged fully in presidential politics that have made it a very different story.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to have to end it in the present. Please join me in thanking David Hackett Fisher and Jim McPherson. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.